This is Rainmaker FM, the digital marketing podcast network. It's built on the Rainmaker platform, which empowers you to build your own digital marketing and sales platform. Start your free 14-day trial at rainmakerplatform.com.
Hi, and welcome to Rough Draft, the podcast about writing on the web. I am your host, Damian Farnworth, the chief content writer for Rainmaker Digital. And thank you for sharing your life with me. So back in the late 90s, I was driving up a hilly two-lane highway toward what was then the most exciting town in the county, a city that sat right off Interstate 64 and boasted a mall. Population was a hairbreadth below 15,000 people. I was alone and headed towards Borders, bent on reading as many poems by Lord Byron as I could before I ran out of coffee money and they kicked me out. And as I drove, the sun was setting and traffic was light, and I was listening to NPR. In particular, I was listening to a show about a man who both fascinated and frightened me. And I can't remember who he was, like even his name, even after spending an hour online searching this morning, hopelessly, with keyword phrases like Bulldog Man NPR. See, I was fascinated by this man because the reporter described him as small, maybe even as a dwarf, or perhaps he had a gimpy leg, but he was unattractive, loud, ham-handed, orphaned. I don't remember, but what was clear was that the deck had been stacked against this guy. Yet, he prevailed at everything he did. I don't know what city he lived in or whether he was pushing for political or civil change, but the words used to describe his personality ranged from relentless to persistent to fierce, and eventually a friend of the man dropped the cliche that we all know and that says, oh, so much. He was like a bulldog. And when I think of a bulldog, I think of Jack London's novel White Fang, where a bulldog named Cherokee nearly kills the hero of the story, which is a wild wolf dog, once the bulldog clamps onto White Fang's throat. And White Fang only survives because someone broke up the illegal dog fight. And in other words, what they were saying about this man in this NPR story was that he got what he wanted. He didn't give up. He clamped down on what he wanted, shook and raged until he got it. And this frightened me, but not because I thought that he might make light work of me, but because the thought running through my mind was this. This guy is a force of nature. He gets what he wants. I'm not a force of nature. So does that mean I don't get what I want? It seemed like a real possibility to me at the time for someone who was driving towards Borders with enough money to buy one, maybe two cups of coffee and read Byron for the entire evening. But there's really no need to feel that sorry for me at this point, because I've more than embraced the fact that I'm less force of nature and more freak of nature. But since then, the point in opening with that story is that since that autumn evening where I was headed to the cultural mecca of Madison County, that NPR story has stayed with me and comes to mind anytime I run into someone who is a force of nature, who is unstoppable. One such person is Professor Robert Siegel. You'll remember Professor Siegel from the last episode where I asked him if anyone took Joseph Campbell serious and his Hero of a Thousand Faces. And that fragment was part of a much larger interview with Dr. Siegel, a force of nature, potentially a bulldog. You see, at the moment, he is the 6th century chair of religious studies at the University of Aberdeen, King's College, Scotland. And now, Dr. Siegel does not have a Scottish accent at all, but what he does have is a brain brimming with facts about Joseph Campbell. If you look at his credentials on his bio at the university's website, you'll see that he's been at this for a long, long time. In fact, he was assistant professor of religion and humanities at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, when I was 3 years old. Almost 40 years ago, folks. This guy's got fellowships and grants from institutions like the American Philosophical Society, National Endowment for the Humanities, British Academy, and Carnegie. He's also the director at the Center for the Study of Myth, University of Aberdeen. He's written 6 books, edited 11, written 7 introductions or forewords, wrote 69 entries in encyclopedias and dictionaries and chapters in books of all sorts, and 105 stout articles in substantial journals. So when it comes to myth, Professor Siegel is your man. And when it comes to Joseph Campbell and his ideas, Professor Siegel's also your man. And that's why I interviewed him, to get to the bottom of this Joseph Campbell and get some questions I had about him and his hero's journey out of the way. So enough with the introduction.
Back in 1986, I wrote a book for an obscure hardback publisher, Garland, which is now part of Taylor and Francis, entitled Joseph Campbell, An Introduction. And then I was able to get it published in cheap paperback with Penguin, and kept the title Joseph Campbell, An Introduction, and just added revised edition. So that came out in 1990. And then it subsequently appeared in a more expensive edition, but then eventually it was declared out of print because sales had petered out. Garland, or then Taylor and Francis, had no reluctance to let me have the rights because it wasn't going to republish it. So I was able to get a contract for another edition with Oxford, but I've just been so behind in other things that I haven't done it yet. So I have a long overdue contract with Oxford University Press to do an even later, more recent edition of the book. And I don't even know whether the title will stay the same, but that's the story. So right now, my book, Joseph Campbell Introduction, is, you can find it on Amazon, but on the whole, it's out of print. And I'm just looking forward to finding the time to do the revision. What will be the big difference is when I did it, Campbell had only been dead a couple of years when I did the revised edition, the paperback. It had only been dead a couple of years. And since then, so much stuff by him, both writings and even more videos of talks he gave, appeared. And I got to know his literary executor, who has been trying to accumulate them all and get the rights to all of them. And it's taken a long time. He told me that Campbell was very lax in claiming rights. He'd give a lecture someplace and somebody would record it and he didn't care. So it's taken a long time. There's now appearing standard edition or simply the collected works of Joseph Campbell, which aims to put in print in a uniform edition all known writings by him, but it's a long-term project.
So it would be safe to say that you're an expert on Joseph Campbell?
Yes.
You are Robert Siegel, and you're from the University of Aberdeen, King's College in Scotland, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And you've been at this for a while, as you just said, and your CV is a litany of fellowships and grants, and I think quite a few other books outside of this Joseph Campbell book. I sort of wanted to talk to you about the influence that Joseph Campbell had and still has, and but I sort of want to set its personal stage for how I was first exposed to Joseph Campbell, and that occurred like in a rock climbing gym about 20 years ago, where I ran into an old friend from grade school, and he and I got talking, and the subject of Christianity came up. My Christianity came up, and so he announces, "Oh, I used to be a Christian."
And then I read Campbell.
Right. And then so he starts going on about, Hero of a Thousand Faces. And but everything he was saying, he was clearly studied in it, but it was kind of a wash. And I walked away with that thinking fixated on this person, Joseph Campbell, and who could have such a strong influence on someone's beliefs like that? But it wasn't until years later that I actually was able to sit down and start, learning about Joseph Campbell. So long story of saying that his book was published in 1949, correct?
Yes.
Okay, right. So at a time, though, when we were steeped and smitten by Freudian psychology, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so how much is his book influenced by Freud?
Not that much. He himself says that after he wrote Hero with a Thousand Faces, yes, first edition, 1949, he became At the time, he says that he was equally taken with Freud and Jung, but that as time went on, he soured on Freud and became much more of a Jungian. The complication is that he claims he became more of a Jungian. It's not, I would say, that he became more of a Freudian. It's that he became less even of a Jungian, and that he went in directions entirely, not just different from Jung, but at odds with Jung. So I would say that one can't quite take him as he, one has to take his claims with a grain of salt. Not because he's in any way.
Who, Jung or Joseph Campbell?
Campbell.
Okay.
Not because Campbell is at all ashamed of being associated with Jung, and quite the contrary, but because I think he just doesn't get straight what he actually is taking from, what he actually is, how much he's actually taking from Jung. And then later than Here with a Thousand Faces, how little he's taking from Jung. So I would say, let me put it this way. The popular reading of Campbell is that Campbell was a popularizer of Jung. When I teach every year here at Aberdeen an upper level undergraduate course on theories of myth. That's my real baby, theories of myth.
Okay.
And in it, I teach both Freud and Jung. Well, I assign writings by Jung, but I assign as the clearest application of Jung to myths, I assign Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces. And what I do is take, say, look, in Here with a Thousand Faces, Campbell is as Jungian as he gets. Despite what he himself says, he doesn't become more Jungian thereafter. If anything, he becomes less Jungian. So I take Campbell as, and Here with a Thousand Faces, the way most people take him, which is as a staunch Jungian and, let's say, a popularizer of Jung. But that's not all there is to Campbell. Campbell didn't even like being thought of as simply a follower. Campbell saw himself as an independent theorist of myth who took stuff from Jung and from lots of other sources and turned it into his own theory. But he certainly did not like being characterized, even when meant favorably, as a Jungian disciple, because that robbed him of, in his mind, his independence.
So how do your students respond to Joseph Campbell?
The ones who come to class and stay awake like him. So no, they do. They're not smitten the way students used to be, and especially in the 60s and 70s. I mean, Here with a Thousand Faces, after all, the theme of Here with a Thousand Faces is that heroism is really a matter of self-discovery. On the surface, on the literal level, self-discovery comes from taking a trip. And Campbell has a scheme in Here with a Thousand Faces in which the hero sets off from home, from the known world, and ventures, often with difficulty, to a strange new world that not only the hero, but everyone back at home has never been to or even known of. The hero then immerses himself, and Campbell, unlike others, allows for female heroes, himself or herself, in this strange new world, becomes initiated into it, and then finally returns home to spread the news. Now, Campbell reads myth both literally and psychologically. And Campbell has contempt for religion. Look, I'm a professor of religious studies. Most theorists of religion or theorists of myth do not do what Campbell does, which is to pit myth against religion. Campbell does. I don't care. I'm not a defender of religion. I'm not a defender of myth either. It's just striking that he pits myth against religion, loves myth, hates religion. And what he argues is that, and it's wrong. I mean, it's just not accurate. What he argues is that religion, and he was raised Catholic, and he hates Catholicism most of all, that what he argues is that religion systematically reads myth literally and thereby misses the symbolic, the psychological significance of myth. So he sees his task as one of really, really reviving an appreciation of myth by severing it from religion and by reading it non-literally, by reading it symbolically, by reading it psychologically. Now, in the 60s and 70s, and beyond that, I'm sure still today, okay, Kimball was a sacred text. Campbell's writing about tripping. That's what he's really writing about. I don't mean on drugs. He was very conservative. But just Campbell was not himself a partisan of the New Age, of hippies, of opponents of the Vietnam War. He was himself very, very conservative. I mean, he supported the Vietnam War. He was conservative in his personal life. But his book, I mean, other books never had the same clout. Although certainly they kept selling and they still sell. But Here Are the Thousand Faces was taken as a guide to self-discovery, which psychologically, which on the literal level means going to a strange new world, becoming initiated in it, and returning home to spread the word. So discovery is discovery on the literal level of a strange new world. Now, on the psychological level, which is the Jungian level, the self-discovery is the discovery of the strange new world that is in you. It is discovery of your unconscious, and specifically the discovery of your Jungian unconscious, which is composed of archetypes. So what Campbell does in Here Are the Thousand Faces is to say, yes, here is my pattern that I claim holds for all hero myths. Look, year in, year out, when I teach the course, I assign students, you know, applications of Campbell to various myths. And Campbell never works fully. But that doesn't deter students. I mean, it's just what they do like is, here you get somebody, he's not the only one, here you get somebody who is prepared to read myths at other than the straightforward literal or historical level, make myths about you, the reader. You know, students, I think, even now respond to it, but not in the way they did in the 60s and 70s. I would say Campbell is still popular, certainly still popular. And really, if there's one theorist of myth that students will have heard of, it's Campbell. I mean, it's more so even than Jung or Freud. There's one theorist of myth that students will, if there's one, there may not be any, but if there's one that students are familiar with, it tends to be Campbell. Campbell also writes in at least seemingly a very accessible way. And he also, he was a professor of literature at swanky Sarah Lawrence College in New York, and not New York City, New York State. And it shows. I mean, he comes to myth from literature. He loves telling myths. I mean, he does, you can see, okay? Students like that. I mean, why shouldn't they like that? I like that too. That is. He doesn't just talk abstractly. He applies what he, you know, he applies his theory to actual myths. And so what I do in writing as well as in teaching is to see how well Campbell works with specific myths. No theorist of myth works perfectly. None does. But some work better than others.
Dr. Siegel, you're going to be so proud of me. You're going to be so proud of me. I actually did my assignment today, sir. So I ran the movie Apocalypse Now through the Joseph Campbell monomyth, like you asked. Would you like to hear it? Okay, so here it goes. Benjamin L. Millard, a demented army captain, is hauled out of his ordinary world, which is terrifying nightmares stirring the night and hard liquor binges, the little bit of dancing in your underwear, hallucinations, and punching mirrors thrown in by day, is brought to an undisclosed mobile home somewhere in Vietnam. And in this creepy scene involving a near-pubescent Harrison Ford, Millard is given a mission, a top-secret assignment to assassinate a Colonel Walter E. Kurtz. This is Millard's call to adventure, all in big, bold caps, call to adventure. This is the first stage. And this is where Millard has the opportunity to refuse the call, all caps, refuse the call, which is a plausible idea. Who really wants to ride up the Nung River into the remote jungle to kill someone who commands a troop of mountain people who worship him as a god? Not many people, but to refuse the call, all caps, refuse the call, means the end of the story. Besides, what's Millard's alternative? Go back to Saigon and descend into his own personal hell in a hotel room again? Instead, he accepts and crosses the threshold, all caps. Note, there is no supernatural aid, all caps, in Apocalypse Now, unless you regard bare-chested Lieutenant Colonel Kilgore, who is actually played by Robert Duvall, a keen surfer and lover of the aroma of napalm, as a supernatural aid, which is also another plausible idea, because it is Kilgore who is the only one who stood calmly during an artillery assault on his troops. And to boot, Kilgore was the one screaming during heavy gunfire that when he says it is safe to surf, it is safe to surf. Here is a man who holds providence in his hands. Supernatural in a sense, don't you think, Dr. Siegel? So, after a little surfing, Kilgore and his crew cover for Willard and the Navy PBR that he's joined. They get the PBR to the mouth of the river, and Willard and company quickly make their way upriver away from Kilgore. And traveling up the river, they are clearly in the belly of the whale, all caps, belly of the whale, the place where they are separated from the ordinary world. This is also where Willard begins to change as he learns about his mark, Kurtz. Kurtz doesn't seem like the type of man the government would want to kill. Something must be wrong. So up the Nung River, Willard and company go. They encounter a tiger, a Playboy Playmates show gone bad at a USO supply depot, a boat full of civilians whom antsy gunner Mr. Clean kills, and a chaotic U.S. outpost under siege. Moreover, Willard and the captain of the boat are at each other's throats during the upriver journey. It is safe to call this portion of the movie The Road of Trials, all caps. Furthermore, the Playboy Playmates scene might fit the woman as temptress stage, all caps. And learning about Kurtz's love for his wife and family in letters among his dossier that Willard's been reading could be the meeting with the goddess, all caps, where love and marriage of the hero occur. Willard finally reaches his target, which turns out to be a pagan idolatry dream come true. Armed, half-naked natives mill about while decapitated bodies cover the banks of the river. In this environment, we meet a euphoric, chain-smoking photojournalist, the Dennis Hopper, who is an avid disciple of Kurtz, and Hopper utters one of the best lines in the movie. "Hey man, you don't talk to the colonel, you listen to him. The man's enlarged my mind. He's a poet warrior in the classic sense. I mean, sometimes he'll, you'll say hello to him, right? And he'll just walk right by you, and he won't even notice you, and suddenly he'll grab you, and he'll throw you in a corner, and he'll say, 'Do you know that if is the middle word in life? If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, I can't. I'm a little man. He's a great man. I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas.'" And so the natives bind Willard and drag him to Kurtz, who's played by Marlon Brando. And then Kurtz, who is suffering from malaria, wipes his head and neck down with a wet rag as he interrogates Willard. Kurtz knows Willard has come to kill him, but he eventually releases Willard, who roams the compound unmolested. And this meeting, Dr. Siegel, might be rendered atonement with the father, all caps, given that Kurtz does not kill Willard, but instead ends up sharing his thoughts about war, civilization, and humanity. Theories informed by poems like T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland and Viet Cong Policies. Willard becomes a disciple. And then Willard, however, out of mercy rather than duty, kills Kurtz with a machete. Simultaneously, by the way, a real-life water buffalo is slaughtered, and there is no CGI in this film, sir, which is why the American Humane Association gave the movie an unacceptable rating. But since this scene was filmed in the Philippines, it wasn't subject to American animal cruelty laws. Anyway, finally, Willard drags the remaining crew member of the boat, one of the original four, the surfer dude whom Kilgore crossed and has been on LSD, all caps, since they crossed the threshold, all caps, away from the natives in the compound, and the movie ends with them driving the boat away. Roll credits, Dr. Siegel. The entire return stages of the monomyth are skipped. That's right, no rest for Willard, which would be the apotheosis, all caps, a period of tranquility before the return, all caps. Rather a transition from one nightmare to the next, one psychological, the other physical. Moreover, it's hard to understand exactly what Willard learned as the ultimate boon, all caps, which would have been some kind of gift, an artifact or piece of knowledge, as you know, sir, that he can take back to civilization. Options, of course, include Kurtz's manuscript and audio recordings. More sentimental would be Kurtz's request that Willard tell his son everything about him. And one could argue that Willard refused the return, all caps, given his growing distaste for the American government, but his sense of obligation to Kurtz's son suggests he'd do otherwise. The magic flight, all caps, which is an escape from the other world with the boon, is usually a fleeting short scene. Well, it is a shorty. Sorry, sir. It is a fleeting short scene. He drives away in the boat, the outboard motor churning the river water. And there's no guides to rescue Willard. Rescue, all caps. From without, all caps. Or to help with the during the crossing of the return threshold, all caps. Because it's more than likely Willard avoids anything that smacks of civilization. And it's debatable whether Willard has become comfortable in his own skin or in this world, so he's no master of two worlds, rather the anti-hero. That's natural, given Apocalypse Now is an anti-war movie. And so the one bright spot in this monomyth tale might be that Willard has the freedom to live without fear of death. Freedom to live, all caps. Death, as indicated in the killing of Kurtz, is a gift. It's a mercy. There are greater horrors in this world to face than death, which is probably a message all in itself, don't you think, Dr. Willard?
What I think Campbell's best work is Here with a Thousand Faces, because he ties his theory to a plot line, which is the hero's journey from home to a strange new world back home. And, you know, each of those main stages has, it's either, I think, five or six sub-stages. And the book is simply presentation of each sub-stage in order as illustrated by one or more either whole myths or portions of myth. So he's very, very easy to read. And, you know, I mean, other theorists of myth either give few examples or just give a single example or separate the theory from the example. He doesn't. He absolutely runs the two together. By the same token, I don't find his writing. He's much too vague. His writing is vague. His writing is rhetorical. I think he gets carried away sometimes in theorizing about myth. But I mean, to his absolute credit. What Campbell does is show that myth is not to be monopolized by, in his view, religion. I mean, not just the Catholic Church, but the Catholic Church, perhaps above all. That myth has its own life, and the life that religion, far from elucidating, covers up. And so, you know, making myth something that you don't have to be religious to accept, that's putting it bluntly. Making myth something that you do not have to be religious to accept and that you might well get more of if you're not religious.
What is he exactly saying you have to accept, though? So, because let's say myths are fictional stories, correct? So what is he saying that we should accept?
That myths are about... Myths are not about outward events. They're not necessarily, they may be historical, but they need not be historical. Mm-hmm. They're not primarily about, let's say, well-known heroes, Moses or Buddha or Jesus. They're not, yes, on the surface, they are about these third persons, okay? And you read about them in myths. He's very open as far as what constitutes myth. Very, very open. Some theorists of myth are very narrow. They, for example, differentiate myth from folktale, or even differentiate myth from what's called legend. Campbell's open-ended, all right? His first example of myth is one of the Grimm's brothers' fairy tales, The Princess and the Frog. So he's very open. What he's saying is, whatever the myth is seemingly about, even myths about seemingly historical figures such as Moses or Jesus or Buddha, that's just on the surface. What myth is really about is about you, you the reader. Myth is talking to you because myth is talking about you. And what is it saying? It's saying that you have a much deeper, fuller side to yourself, which you should, you know, which you sort of owe to yourself to explore. Psychologically, that's the unconscious.
So does that make him more of a psychologist than?
Yes, yes, that's what he is. He's a psychologist. His theory of myth is primarily psychological.
So
not exclusively, but primarily, yeah.
Okay, so you said something earlier that you said he was open to female heroes. I've read that one of the criticisms for, you know, the Hero of a Thousand Faces is that it's male bias.
Yeah, there's let's put it this way. If I've never done it. If one were to count the number of heroes who were in the dozens, the scores, in Hero of a Thousand Faces, there would be at least as many female heroes as male heroes. So those who say that, which people do, that Campbell was narrow-minded or sexist or whatever, or to start with simply counting the number of heroes that Campbell presents. Campbell's first hero is a princess, not a prince, it's a princess who loses her ball and and has it retrieved by a frog. The hero at the beginning of Hero of a Thousand Faces, Campbell's first chosen example, is female, not male. At the same time, when Campbell gets to, he's just inconsistent. I don't understand why he didn't think things through more fully. Look, when it comes to stage two of Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is the stage of arrival at the strange new world and initiation into that strange new world, suddenly, without any kind of explanation, heroes are no longer female as well as males. Well, male, they're exclusively female because of what the task is in the second stage, which he calls initiation. Mm-hmm. The hero's job in the second stage is to encounter a male god and defeat that male god, and to seduce a female god. Now, it would be easy for Campbell to have reversed, to have opened things up and said, look, the hero in the middle stage of initiation, can be either male or female. If it's a female hero, the female hero will be defeating a female god and will be seducing a male god. And if it's a male hero, the male hero will do the reverse. What's screwy about Campbell, screwy is the term I like to use, is that even though he has female heroes in stage one, stage of separation, of departure from home, and he has female heroes in the third stage, the stage of return. When it comes to the middle stage, the stage of initiation, suddenly, out of the blue, inexplicably, he in effect limits heroes to male heroes because he's talking about straight sex, put it that way. Mm. He is not talking about female heroes seducing female gods, and he's not talking about female heroes defeating male gods. I mean, it's very, very narrow. Ironically, it's very Freudian, or so it seems, because it seems like the Oedipus complex. Here we have he in effect limits it to male heroes. Formerly, he's not. He even names some female heroes in the middle stage. It's just that what the middle stage is supposed to accomplish for the hero only applies for him to male heroes. That's the sense in which he is, in effect, excluding female heroes. Why, again, he couldn't open himself up in the second stage to female as well as male heroes, I have absolutely no idea. But what seems Freudian, ironically, is that we seem to have, when we have a male hero, we seem to have the enactment of the Oedipus complex. We have fight between between younger and older male, that is between hero and male god, over the older female. I mean, it's just it seems to demand a Freudian interpretation where the hero is confronting his own father over access to his own mother. All right, it's not Freudian. This is the point. The hero is ordinarily a human being, male or female. And the gods, male and female alike, are gods. They are not the parents of the hero. So there's really no possibility that what we really have acted out is anything Freudian. What are the figure? What are the gods? The gods are what Jung calls archetypes. They are aspects of the personality of the hero himself or herself. So it's not Freudian, although it might, you know, at first glance seem to be.
So let me ask you a personal question. Well, what attracted you to Joseph Campbell?
That he writes on myth.
That's it.
And so some people think of Campbell as a guru, okay? I don't. What interests me was that he writes on myth, that he's I don't even care that he's an evangelist for myth, which he absolutely is. I mean, he is really he wants to maybe even more than Jung. Jung is an evangelist for myth, but Jung technically allows for human fulfillment, at least on the part of the elite, without myth. So he's a snob. Campbell's not. I mean, for Campbell, myth is something that you can't do without. Campbell actually has statements, not in Here with a Thousand Faces, but in a collection called Myths to Live By, in which he actually says that juvenile delinquency or crime in general are up, at least when he wrote the essay, because people are cut off from myths. If they had myths, there'd be much less delinquency and much less crime. Now, Jung would never say that. I mean, that's crazy to say that, but it shows the...
So you don't believe that?
No. It's just a highfalutin view to use one of Campbell's phrases, the power of myth. Mm. No, I don't think myth for him is both necessary and sufficient for human fulfillment. That's Campbell.
So, what do you hope to get out of teaching Campbell then to students?
Now listen, I'm a pure academic. What I get out of teaching Campbell is helping them see what Campbell is saying. I teach myth as comparisons of theorists, and I'm not advocating one or the other. We do something like 10 theorists over the semester. All I ask is that students see what is distinctive about each theorist and know how to apply them. But I would never imagine that students take Campbell to heart the way you do. I just don't think. Now, and I don't think it's because they're British. I mean, Campbell never made the splash in the UK that he made in the US. Never. Okay. That's of interest in its own right. I mean, I've never figured out why. When I revise my book, Joseph Campbell, an Introduction, I do intend to deal with the big difference in popularity between Campbell in the US and Campbell in the UK. It's not that he's unknown in the UK. It's just he never had the audience that he had in the U.S. So again, me as an academic, okay, a mere academic, all right, not spiritually inclined, just a pure, rational, hopelessly rational academic. I want students to understand the nature of myth and understand it by understanding the main approaches to myth. Campbell's is one, although I don't think Campbell is as original as he himself thought. I think of him as at least early on, as a Jungian. I will say to enhance his originality, what Campbell does after Hero is, it's not crazy. He's entitled to change his mind. Anyone's entitled to change his mind, okay? Especially if he's running for the Republican nomination for the presidency. Anyway, what Campbell does is simply just reject, in effect, what he'd been arguing for all before. He writes in his final work, final opus, you know, which he never finished. It's called Atlas of World Mythology. I'll give you this as an example. Okay. Now, the one thing that Campbell, as both a Freud, as like Jung and also like Freud, previously insisted on was that the commonness of myth, the similarities among myths, that's what theorists try to explain. Why are myths similar? Not why are they different. Why are they similar? And the answer varies from theory to theory. But what all theorists of myth say is that whatever the reason that theories are, that whatever the reason the theory gives that all myths are similar, all right, is some universal, usually need, some universal need that appears, well, either in all cultures or in all cultures that have myth. I mean, for some theorists, not all cultures have myth. For all theorists, at least most cultures do. Now, the opposite of that view, which is the view of all theorists, is the view that Campbell, again, out of the blue, unannounced, takes up in his last unfinished multi-volume work, Atlas, The Atlas. Because there what he does is take up, unannounced, unexplained, he takes up the opposite view. The view that the reason for the similarities among myths is that myth starts in one place and spreads. And it's not a universal need, it's cultural contact that accounts for the similarities. He's the kind of guy, Campbell, who would have liked, I don't know whether he ever wrote on this. Do you know about the Kon-Tiki, about Kon-Tiki?
No, uh-uh.
Okay, well, all right. So this was, I don't know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago. I think he was English. I don't know. He was certainly European. Guy argued that culture could spread from across the ocean, even though the distance seemed insurmountable. So he built a boat, a little boat called Kon-Tiki, and, you know, made of wood, I think. And he managed to go from, I forget, across the world or across portions of the world. And that was an argument for what is called diffusion, which is, so he's saying, look, if I can do it in my rinky-dinky boat, then so could people, you know, hundreds of years earlier. And in other words, if I can make it across the ocean or part of the ocean, then it shows that culture can spread that way. So Campbell's the kind of guy who would have, he was around when Kon-Tiki, it's a Scandinavian guy who did it, Thor something. And Campbell would have loved, not the Campbell of Hero with a Thousand Faces, who would have abhorred that, but the Campbell of The Atlas. So what The Atlas argues again is it's filled with maps, all right? You don't get that in Hero with a Thousand Faces. Why would you need maps in Hero with a Thousand Faces? Myths start in every culture on its own, or every culture that has myth. It starts on its own. And you don't worry about how does Egyptian mythology affect, Indian mythology. They don't affect each other, or if they do, it's incidental. And here are the Thousand Faces. Egyptian mythology has heroes because it has the hero archetype. Egyptians come up with Egyptian heroes because they have the hero archetype built into them. Indian myth makers come up with Indian heroes because they have the hero archetype built into them.
So was the Campbell of The Atlas then saying that the myths were getting spread and so
yes,
they were going to blend? So he abandoned the idea of the archetype within?
Absolutely.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying he ever said so, but I don't see how we can. I have a very lot of mind, if I may say so. I just don't see how we can reconcile what's called the diffusionism or culture spread of mythology with the Jungian analysis or even Freudian in Here with a Thousand Faces, and not just Here with a Thousand Faces, but in many subsequent books. So he just, one could say, after all, he lived a long life. He's entitled to change his mind. I don't care. It's just that it's unexplained. In other words, he doesn't say, I'm now approaching similarities. That's what all theorists do. I'm now approaching similarities in terms of culture spread, where previously I had explain similarities in terms of independent, you know, individual archetypes, culture by culture, culture by case. He just does it. He doesn't try to reconcile the one with the other. I just, my mind doesn't work that way. So I would see the need to, I would see the need to justify inconsistency or to overcome inconsistency. So, but I don't think, look, I don't think the Atlas, his executor who told me that the executor actually wrote some of the Atlas. I mean, I'm sure he did, that the Atlas was never finished. And I don't know how many volumes it's supposed to be, but I think, you know, something like 2.5 volumes eventually came out. But it never had the impact that Here with a Thousand Faces did. What's nice about Here with a Thousand Faces is that you don't have to know history, you don't have to know geography. You just take each myth, you take myths by themselves. I mean, it's so different of you from what he does in Atlas, and I just don't think Atlas has the same appeal. And also in Atlas, which is not inconsistency. I mean, he's not interested in heroes. He wasn't always interested in heroes, but he certainly started with heroes, and he wrote other stuff on heroes. Heroes is an attractive subject. Many people are interested in myths, but if your specialty is within that hero myths, you have an audience much easier to amass than if you write about, say, creation myths. Although even they are popular.
Let me end on this. One of the influences of Hero of the Thousand Faces is what it's had on writers, screenwriters. I think there's, you know, a tale of George Lucas claiming that he, after reading it, he went back and changed, you know, his script for Star Wars, and there's other movies. So what are you... is that something you agree with? But also, more importantly, is like, what are lessons that writers can take up? Because part of my interest in Campbell is because of the hero journey and using that framework to create, you know, my own stories. So what are your thoughts about that for writers and using Campbell in that way?
Let me put it this way. There are people who make a living in Hollywood. I'm not sure they're all based in Hollywood. By teaching would-be scriptwriters how to write. And some of them use Campbell. They say, look. Campbell offers us, this is the point, this is why Here with a Thousand Faces is so much more appealing than subsequent books, especially Atlas. Look, they simplify Campbell. I don't think Campbell's that complicated anyway, but they simplify Campbell into almost bullet points. All right, you got to have a hero who starts off from the known world. You got to have a hero who is chosen for qualities that make for success in the journey. You have to have a world that the hero has never been to or even known exists. You have to figure out how the hero gets from home to the new world. You've got to fill the new world with figures that the hero has never even known, let alone encountered. And you've got to make the hero successful in the encounter with these figures. And then you've got to get the hero to be willing to come back home. Now, there are teachers of books on screenwriting or script writing who take it. I'm not saying Campbell's the only person that's used, but Campbell just is so easy. Campbell is so accessible. There are books, how to write a script following Joseph Campbell's pattern. I think it takes more than the pattern. Lucas is wrong. I mean, Here with a Thousand Faces doesn't fit Star Wars. Whatever Lucas says, he's wrong, okay? He's wrong. I've tried it. I mean, a long time ago, applying Campbell to Star Wars. It doesn't work. But it's extraordinary that, who could deny it, would credit Campbell with inspiring him to, I don't know at what point he read Campbell, but certainly he gives great credit to Campbell. He invited Campbell to his ranch, and he probably gave him 10% discount on tickets to Star Wars. Maybe it was only 5%. I don't know. But
do you think Campbell approved of that use of his work?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Kimball, I think, was not averse to fame. Oh, I'm sure he loved it. I mean, Kimball never thought of himself as certainly didn't think himself as an academic. I mean, he had contempt for academics, and he thought they were pedantic.
Was that because he was rejected for
no? I understand. Look, I don't know this part, okay? But there are biographies of Kimball. Kimball did well, very well, at Columbia University in New York as an undergrad. He did very well, and he won a fellowship, traveling fellowship, to spend, I think it was 2 years in Paris. I think it was Paris. Okay. You know, I mean, those don't come easily. So he did that, and then instead of going back to, wait, and then he returned to Columbia and he got a master's. But instead of going on to a PhD, which he absolutely could have done, all right? I mean, and I don't know why, he just wanted to see more of the world. So he went to the West Coast and linked up with people like John Steinbeck, and then he started writing. And later he got a job at St. Lawrence College and stayed there all his career. And St. Lawrence didn't require a PhD, which he never got. I assume was happy to have him. Also, St. Lawrence is just an undergrad. You know, it's a liberal arts college. It's just an undergraduate school. So there was no obligation to turn out scholarly articles. So Kimball is not a scholar, and there's stuff that he knows and there's stuff that he doesn't know. But I don't think he ever considered himself rejected. I don't think he ever considered himself rejected by the academic world. He could easily have had a fine academic career. I think he just didn't want one because he wanted his constituency to be, you know, broader than an academic one. So he never wrote. I mean, you know, when I did my book, I certainly compiled everything I could find by him. And he never wrote. He just didn't write academic articles. And he certainly didn't write academic books. And he easily survived. He more than survived. There are plenty of people who would, you know, who would cut off their ear to have had Kimball's success.
So do you see what I mean about Dr. Siegel being a force of nature? Each one of my questions is a flap of a butterfly wing that sets off Dr. Siegel and his hurricane force wind sweeps across the globe. I know that's a silly simile, but you get what I mean. Dr. Siegel, thank you for the interview, and thank you to Francis Ford Coppola for directing the film Apocalypse Now. And, remember several episodes ago where I talked about how I watched that movie, the Apocalypse Now, because I needed a word but didn't find the word I was looking for after watching that movie and perhaps question whether that 2 hours and 48 minutes was wasted? Well, see, I salvaged that sucker. I also want to thank the folks behind the Rainmaker FM Podcast Network, people working so hard behind the scenes to make this show great and other shows great, people like Toby Lyles and Caroline Early and Kelton Reed. And speaking of Kelton, he's got a great podcast called The Writer Files, and it's a fun interviews where Kelton studies the habits and habitats and brains of a wide spectrum of renowned writers to learn their secrets of productivity and creativity. And he's also got a series with neuroscientist Michael Gripko covering topics like storytelling, empathy, and creativity, which are some of my favorite episodes. Go and check that show out. It's The Writer Files. Give it a listen and then give it a rating and a review on iTunes. And while you're at it, give Rough Draft a rating and review if you haven't already. It's one of the great best ways you can support the show. You can also support the show by listening, subscribing, and sharing each show on social media. And so go ahead and do that right now. Drop what you are doing and share this episode on social media. Email it to a friend, drop it on Facebook, go and leave a rating and review on iTunes while you're at it. And I'm not going to go away until I get what I want, okay? So go drop what you're doing and do it right now, because I'm not going to leave until you do it right now. So that was my impression of a bulldog, and it kind of stressed me out. What do you think? Was I believable or not? Or should I stick with the more sleepy pussycat vibe? Drop me a note on Twitter or on the comments on this blog to let me know what you think. And if you don't, I'm not going to chase you down, I promise. And until next time, take care.